Thanks for listening to Think Out Loud Online. While you're here, why not support OPB and Think Out Loud? Just click on the Contribute Now button. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Dave Miller. Today on Think Out Loud, we'll talk to the pollster who recently asked Oregonians if they thought the state is moving in the right direction. We'll find out how people answered and how their attitudes have changed in the last 4 months. At the end of the show, we'll talk to a professor at the U of O. She and many of her colleagues are hoping to unionize the faculty. We start today with a recent ruling from the federal court in Eugene. 3 years ago, a man in Eugene was arrested while he was protesting in front of a bank. The man videotaped his conversation with his arresting officer. That officer then took his camera and, without getting a warrant, watched the footage. In the first ruling of its kind in Oregon, a federal judge ruled earlier this month that this was a violation of the Fourth Amendment, that it was an illegal search and seizure. Courts in other parts of the country have come to very different conclusions. So what do you think is a reasonable search when so many of us carry so much personal information in the palm of our hands? Our number, 1-888-665-5865, online, or opb.org/thinkoutloud. I'm joined right now by Evan Brown. He's a technology attorney with Hinshaw and Culbertson in Chicago. He joins us from WBEZ. Evan Brown, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dave. It's great to be here.
So I laid out some of the basic facts of this case. It'd be great if you can lay out the basic facts of the Fourth Amendment for us. What does the Fourth Amendment guarantee?
Well, the Fourth Amendment is, obviously, it's in the Constitution. It's part of the Bill of Rights. And it gives American citizens the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. And that has translated into what we think colloquially or offhand as a right to privacy. When when we're being investigated by law enforcement or when we're being arrested, the Fourth Amendment gives us the security that the cops won't be rummaging through our stuff unless either they have a warrant or there is a reason for them to search what we have or search our possessions that based on some other kind of reasoning like that. So that's the privilege that we enjoy under the Fourth Amendment.
You mentioned unless there's a warrant, but what other exceptions are there in general to this law against warrantless searches?
When you're being arrested, the cops can do a search, what they call search incident to a lawful arrest. There can be other what they call exigent circumstances that would justify doing a search if somebody, if for example, evidence is running the risk of being destroyed, or if there's something that law enforcement has to do to protect the safety of the officer, looking for a gun, looking for other kind of weapon that could be used against the officer. So in general, a warrant is required, and the courts are very clear that we're unwilling to allow warrantless searches unless there are certain circumstances that justify a warrantless search. The courts say that that this is a right that's jealously guarded, and so the courts will look very closely in determining whether or not a search was done in accordance with the protections of the Fourth Amendment.
One of the lines that came up a couple times in Judge Coffin, he is the judge in Eugene that we're talking about, it's his ruling that came out a couple weeks ago. One of the lines that kept coming up was this idea of the closed container. What is a closed container when it comes to Fourth Amendment law?
It's an interesting concept that comes to us from long before the time people were carrying around mobile devices that contain a lot of information in them. At the beginning of our conversation a moment ago, I was talking about an exception to the Fourth Amendment requirement for a warrant, and that is when it's a search incident to a lawful arrest. And a search that is okay under the Fourth Amendment that is incident to a lawful arrest is when the police are either searching the defendant, the suspect's person, you know, items that are actually, you know, with the person, either in a pocket or something like that, or in an area within the suspect's immediate control. So this idea of a closed container is relevant when we're thinking about talking about searches that the police do of the defendant's person. The notion of a closed container comes to us from a Supreme Court case back in 1973, like I said, long before people were carrying around mobile devices with a lot of information on them, a Supreme Court case called Robinson. And in that case, the cops had arrested a guy on suspicion of trafficking drugs or you know, at least possessing drugs. I don't remember precisely, but the cops reached into his pocket and felt a crumpled up cigarette container and could tell that there was something other than cigarettes in this container. It turned out to be rocks of heroin. So that from that set of facts, we get this idea that it's appropriate for law enforcement to look in closed containers like a crumpled up cigarette carton that's actually contained on a suspect, a defendant's person.
So, but Judge Coffin said that that a camera or an iPhone or, you know, some kind of electronic device like that is not a closed container in the same sense. So why not? What was his reasoning?
Well, it seems pretty sensible, doesn't it? A mobile phone, a digital camera, any kind of mobile device like that that can store just, you know, unfathomable amounts of information is a lot unlike a cigarette carton that has information in it. So it's obviously just very different in nature and in character for the reasons that we're talking about here. He says something like, if you were to actually print out and look at all the information that is on a mobile device like this, a person would have to carry around a large suitcase or maybe a file cabinet. So it's just very different in nature than the closed container that that factually has given rise to this doctrine. And moreover, when you open up a phone, you don't see what's actually contained in it. I mean, you know, you don't open up the phone and see the data that you're actually looking for, like the phone numbers or something like that. And you open it up and you see, or you open up the camera and you see, you know, microchips and little wires and things like that. So for those reasons, the metaphor breaks down. The idea of it being a closed container just doesn't make sense, especially when we're talking about something as important as a person's civil rights in connection with being arrested.
You're listening to Think Out Loud on OPB. We're talking right now about a recent ruling from a federal judge in Eugene. He found that an arresting officer is not allowed to view a suspect's cell phone contents or camera or tablet or whatever without a warrant. If you have experience with this recently, maybe from participating in recent Occupy protests, we'd love to hear your story. Our number is 1-888-665-5865. OPB.org/thinkoutloud is our website. Evan Brown, I'm glad you brought up that Judge Coffin's line about, you know, if you were going to have this much information not in digital form, you'd have it in one or more large suitcases, if not file cabinets. If somebody did have a file cabinet on the front seat next to them in their car and they're pulled over and then arrested lawfully, would officers have the right to open up that file cabinet?
Well, in so many situations like this, it's going to depend on the actual circumstances. The real justification for allowing these warrantless searches, what we're calling searches incident to a lawful arrest, is really twofold. One, to protect officer safety. We don't want the defendant reaching for a gun or a weapon that could be used to harm the officer, or for the suspect to get rid of evidence that might be done away with, like the bag of drugs being thrown out the window or something like that. So if the circumstances in what you're talking about here are such that the officer would be justified in looking through that box that's there, roughly contemporaneous with the arrest, and I'm using some language, you know, that the courts have used to describe that, then that would be appropriate. If it's too remote in time, or if it's, by that I mean long after the arrest has been made and the suspect is back at the police station and the box has been away from him for several hours, that's not going to be reasonable. It's not going to be something that would be considered appropriate under this analysis that we're doing here. But if the guy's sitting in the front seat and he could easily reach over into that box and pull out a gun, then the search of that box for the officer to ensure that there's not a gun in there, then that's something that would much more likely be considered a lawful search in this analysis that we're talking about.
We've got a question on our blog that goes in the exact opposite direction. You know, I'm pushing this towards the analog world, the offline world of printed out pieces of paper in a box. But Soggy Portlander on our site asks, when you focus on digital data, are any distinctions made about where it resides? As cloud services are increased, our personal data is going to reside all over the place. Will our civil liberties be protected regardless of whether our data is physically on a device or at some server farm? Evan Brown, this is not necessarily an academic question anymore. We already have tons of cloud services, and much of our data, is in some farm, in a desert somewhere.
Right. That, in my mind, is one of the most important questions that face us today when we're talking and thinking about digital privacy. It's one thing to have the legal analysis that you do when the data is actually on your person, if you're carrying around a phone in your pocket, or if you have a digital camera like what Mr. Schlossberg in the case here is dealing with. But every single one of us, even the most casual user of the World Wide Web, the Internet, using some kind of cloud service, is going to have information that's out there. If you use Google Docs to collaborate on something, if you use Dropbox to share files, if you upload photos to Flickr, not only is that content there, but there's information about that is in the possession and custody of a third party. And when we're thinking about that expectation of privacy that we have in that, which is relevant to the question of whether or not a law enforcement search of this content is reasonable, there's this idea called the third party doctrine. Comes from another Supreme Court case, this one from the early 1980s. But in general, the general rule is if your property, if your stuff is with a third party, with someone else, then you don't have that reasonable expectation of privacy. And so, for example, if I have the question is, if I have information, say I'm a drug dealer and I have the list of people I'm selling drugs to and I store that on Dropbox, does law enforcement need a warrant to either send a subpoena or, somehow access the content of my information online? That's an open question. We have had some limited guidance from the courts. Fortunately, some cases, most recently, just in the past couple of weeks, the state Supreme Court in Missouri held that a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy when it comes to text messages that are stored on the provider's system. So, but by no means is that question settled. And clearly, with so many more people using cloud services, knowingly or even unwittingly, that is one of the most pressing issues of personal digital privacy that we're facing as a society today.
Moving back to this question of searches that might happen during an arrest, neither the Supreme Court nor the Ninth Circuit have taken up this question that we're talking about, but other courts have, and some of them, as I mentioned in the intro, have come to different conclusions. Just give us a summary, if you will, about what other courts in other parts of the country have said.
Probably the most problematic decision on this issue comes from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the appellate court that includes, among other states, Texas. It's a case called Finley. And in that case, the court held that it was okay, it was not a violation of the defendant's Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches and seizures when the cops looked at the content of his cell phone. I think in that case he was being arrested for drugs, so it was a little bit different facts, but that really shouldn't matter too much in all of this, because the court's analysis in the Finley case, and this came out I think it was a 2007 case, held that it was because the cell phone could be on the suspect's person, like in his pocket. Once he was arrested, he really had no expectation of privacy in that. It was really the closed container analysis that we were talking about a few moments ago. And Magistrate Judge Coffin, in the case that we're talking about from Oregon, this current case, really is just comes to the different conclusion. Comes to a different conclusion because of the nature of what the mobile device is, and it doesn't make any sense. And in fact, it could lead to some really dire consequences for people's dignitary interests, their privacy rights, if we are to treat cell phones as something small that can contain information that's subject to a search, akin to the cigarette package, like we were talking about in the Robinson case. So the Fifth Circuit's case, the Fifth Circuit's decision in Finley was the most opposite, the highest court that has opined on this issue. The Supreme Court of Ohio has made a decision that's more in line with the Oregon courts that had to do with text messages and recognized kind of the strangeness that comes about from thinking of them as closed containers. The Supreme Court of California has been more in line with the Finley Court from the Fifth Circuit, treating cell phones more as closed containers. So you can see there's a split. There's definitely the courts are definitely saying different things in different parts of the country that makes this. Certainly it's a difficult issue to even think about, and it's made even more concerning because of the fact that courts are saying different things around the country, making it very unsettled.
Which also makes it seem that it's just going to go higher up in the court system if history is any guide. One last question, this one from our website, from Concerned99er, who asks, how are these types of searches affected by the Patriot Act or other anti-terrorism legislation like the recent indefinite detention bill? Any idea, Evan Brown, about how, say, the Patriot Act might affect these kinds of searches?
Well, the Patriot Act, there are certain other, there are certain laws that have come under the scope of the Patriot Act, like the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and the Stored Communications Act, and so those types of statutes, particularly the Stored Communications Act, which in shorthand is the statute that protects people and sets up certain processes for storing or for, among other things, law enforcement's access to stored emails or stored text messages or something like that. Those types of things can be implicated because what the Stored Communications Act does try to do is build in a privacy protection that's contemplated by the Fourth Amendment. It really is a subject for another day and another more complex analysis, thinking about the international implications, what rights foreign citizens may have under the Fourth Amendment. It's much more problematic and really kind of much more than what we would want to delve in on this. Suffice it to say that there's plenty of overlap and plenty of complexity brought in by the international scope of it.
Well, Evan Brown, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Evan Brown is a technology attorney with Hinshaw & Culbertson. He's based in Chicago. He joined us from WBEZ in Chicago. You're listening to Think Out Loud. Coming up, we're going to dig into the results of a recent OPB survey about the economy, elected officials, and the direction Oregon is headed. Stay tuned. You're listening to Think Out Loud on OPB. I'm Dave Miller. Today, OPB News released the results from a survey of 500 Oregonians. The survey was conducted last week. It looked into approval ratings for Governor Kitzhaber and President Obama and for the legislature and environmental organizations. It asked if people felt they're better off financially than they were 2 years ago. And most simply, people were asked if the state is heading in the right direction or on the wrong track. We'll get into their answers to those questions and more today. We'll also take your calls and comments as we go. Is Oregon heading in the right direction or is it on the wrong track? What's the view from your corner of the Northwest? Our number is 1-888-665-5865. Online, we're opb.org/thinkoutloud. I'm joined now by Sue Mitchell, a managing partner at DHM Research, which conducted this survey. Sue, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So first of all, how was the survey conducted?
It was a random scientific telephone survey of 500 Oregonians. We place very careful quotas to make sure we have a representative sample. Specifically, we look for area of state, representation, age, and gender.
We got a comment from Trill9 who says, our 1,200 survey participants, I guess you said 500, but so is that number of participants really enough to accurately gauge a sentiment of Pacific Northwest residents? And does it include the opinions of underrepresented people?
We often conduct statewide surveys with a 500 and 600 sample, and that is sufficient to look at general mood, general sentiments. When we look into specific subgroup areas like gender and age, then we want to see larger sample sizes. We did take careful we were very careful to make sure that we have wireless samples so that we can get to the younger population as well.
Oh, if you only go with landlines and it skews older, is that the basic idea?
It can be problematic with just landlines, especially when we consider in the urban areas, 20 to 40% of residents are cell only.
So you have to make sure you get some of those cell phones in there. So the big headline that came from the survey was about the general mood of Oregonians. 42% said that Oregon is moving in the right direction. 40% said it's on the wrong track. Did this stand out to you, these numbers?
The optimism definitely did. We haven't seen numbers like this for a few years now. So 42%, while it's not great, it's a lot better than we've seen 4 months ago, even 3 years ago. It's not as good as we've seen in the past. Right? Numbers typically in terms of right direction during good economy, we're in the 65%. So 42 isn't as high as that, but it's getting better. And we found that across the state, the folks who are telling us that things are moving in the right direction tend to be in the Tri-County area. They're female, they're younger, and they're also Democrats.
What does that tell you? I mean, those various demographic details. When I was looking also, I saw that that people making less than $50,000 a year seemed to be happier or more optimistic than people making more than that, which was maybe it was at least a surprise to me.
I think it's just general optimism. People have seen more dire financial situations and things can't be getting worse, right? So they want to feel like things are getting better. And we see that general mood of just overall positive attitude throughout the survey questions.
Now, we should note that this that 2% spread between people who say it's moving in the right direction or on the wrong track is within the margin of error. But from your perspective, it's still a significant finding?
It is within the margin of error, which is about 4.5%. But what's significant is the trend that we've seen over the last few years.
So remind us what that trend is. You said it's more than that you saw even 4 months ago. What was it 4 months ago?
It was about 10% lower 4 months ago. Before that, we've seen as low as 25%, saying that things were moving in the right direction.
Do you have a sense for what happened in the last 4 months to account for that kind of a shift, that 10% more Oregonians say, yeah, we're going in the right direction?
I think it's just general optimism. People are wanting to believe that things are moving in the right direction. And we're seeing that for approval ratings for our elected officials as well as for the legislature. And with the session starting up soon, I think there's a lot of expectations to see things moving forward.
Our number is 1-888-665-5865. The website's opb.org/thinkoutloud. We're talking right now about the results of a survey commissioned by OPB that were released today. We want to know if you personally feel better or worse off than you did 2 years ago, whether you're looking financially or just the general mood, if we're heading in the right direction as a state. Do you agree that with 42% of your fellow Oregonians that we're moving in the right direction? 1-888-665-5865, opb.org/thinkoutloud. Christian Foden-Wenzel is here, reporter for OPB News, who's been covering not just the economy for a while, mm-hmm. but has been following up on some of the people from this survey. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, let's start with you. You called a couple of people who had been called for the survey to get their stories.
Yeah.
Who did you talk to?
Well, I spoke to maybe about a half dozen people, more than that probably. And what struck me when I talked to Sue just outside the studio just now is to get one of those surveys finished, it was what, 100 phone calls or 300 phone calls? Just explain that again. What were you saying?
Now, let's keep in mind that this survey is with the general population. Oftentimes, surveys are noted from voter studies. This was not one of them.
Mm-hmm. So this is not the electorate.
This is not the electorate.
Oregonians 18 and over.
That's right. So to reach one completed survey with voters, we're making about 30 calls. To reach the general population, it's about 300 calls to get one.
Wait, so for one person who responds to the survey, you have to call 300 people and then 299 of them basically just hang up on you?
They're either not available, their phone's busy, or we just can't complete them.
And young people are really much more difficult. She was saying older people have a bit more time maybe and more relaxed, but apparently young people are very difficult. Anyway, the point, you asked me a question.
but it's fascinating.
Yeah, well, they gave me a list of all the people who they'd successfully talked to, so it was very easy for me to call. And they'd,
does take something like 12 minutes, right? I mean, you're asking for some bit of people's time, so it's a little bit of an investment, Sue.
It is. They cared about these issues.
Yeah. So yeah, I managed to talk to several, you know, half a dozen people, and it really is very specific. You know, you talk to one person and they're like, no, there are no green shoots in the economy. Don't tell me people are more optimistic because that's not what I'm seeing. And then you talk to some other people and they're like, yeah, you know, I see a few little things. Just people are less stressed than they were a few months ago. I spoke to one woman, Michelle Shames. She lives out in Klamath Falls and just graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree in applied psychology. I think she was in her 40s. And she's feeling positive, she says, because Barack Obama's in. She really likes him. And she feels like he's going to get reelected and do some of the things that the nation needs. But she also was quite bullish on the economy.
Definitely hearing about more jobs. In fact, as I'm pacing, talking to you, on my table, I have my resume pulled up, and on my table I have over 20 job applications. So I don't have any doubts that I'll get a job.
Yeah, so she was talking about customer care representatives, sales clerks, temporary meter readers, teaching positions, those kind of things. And then she hopes to get in on the low rung and then move on up.
So you know, it's so interesting because I can easily imagine you having talked to somebody who was pacing, looking at her kitchen table with 20 job applications, who said the exact opposite thing. I'm terrified. I have 20 job applications. I don't think I'm going to get a job. And we've heard that exact phrase from other people, yet she's optimistic.
And that's what's so interesting about something, about optimism, because it can change and different people's experiences. Suddenly you spin, and it's not just one person, but if enough people hear this kind of optimism, they then become optimistic. And I think I've heard a lot of people say, oh, you in the news, you're always being negative and things like that. And I think, you know, people do listen and try and figure out, where are we going? So that's why I think this particular poll is quite interesting.
This reminds me of, in case people didn't hear the piece you did this morning, mm-hmm. you talked to a general contractor or a contractor who sort of has his finger on some part of the pulse of the economy, of new home construction or work that people are having done. What was his basic take?
Yeah, well, he said, yes, I'm more optimistic. And his job was hooking up new homes to the sewer system. So I said, oh, does that mean, you know, a lot more buildings going up in Astoria?
New housing starts.
Yeah. And he's like, well, no, I'm not seeing any new buildings going up. But people are calling me straight away when they have a problem. They're not leaving it long. You know, they're like, I've got a problem, I'm going to pay for it, I've got the money, it needs to be done. So it's more, and they're not delaying things. So that was quite interesting, I thought. So
I should mention that we put your story and a full PDF of the survey results up on our website, opb.org/thinkoutloud, so folks can see it there. Now, we heard from Michelle just now, who is pretty positive with her 20 job applications. Mm-hmm. She says she's going to get one. But you talked to some folks who were less positive.
Yeah, absolutely. About half of everyone the researchers called said the financial situation was about the same as 2 years ago. That's what we're saying, about half of them. And a third say they were worse off. Only 16% said they were better off than 2 years ago. This chap I spoke to, Dave Husted, he's 41 years old. He's a fabricator out in Myrtle Point, which is in southern Oregon. So you've got a hunting rifle, and you need a really soft trigger. He will take that trigger, refabricate it, and put it back in your gun so it works well. So he's pretty negative. He says he doesn't think the state's headed in the right direction.
We have onerous regulations. Our local little town here, we're a tiny little town, and our hookups just went from 8,000 to 22,000. That might be the last house built in our town. We're over-regulating. We're making it exceptionally difficult for any businesses to locate or start up in our state.
Yeah, so when he says hookup, he means, again, where the water is hooked up to the house and that bill's gone from 8,000 to 22,000. And he says he doesn't.
The fees that a city or a locality might charge.
Exactly. And he thinks that means no more buildings are going to get built in that town. And he was, you know, he was very negative. And his wife had just, I think, lost her health benefits or had to pay extra or something like that. So it's very specific. You talk to specific people and they have a very strong position their own. But then there did seem to be more people than we talked to before in other polls who were more positive. So
our number again, 1-888-665-5865, opb.org/thinkoutloud is our website. Lootguard on our site says, my son-in-law finally found a job after an extended unemployment, as well as several friends, and my son finally decided to go back to school. In my life, things are looking up. Sue, I guess that gets to, I mean, some of the specifics that you're talking about here, that it gets very particular when people are optimistic or not. But then there also is this sort of mood that seems to just sort of float around. As Christian's talking in it, we heard these specifics either from people he talked to or from Lootguard on our site. Is there any way that you could get to these specifics, these stories, in a big survey?
We didn't ask open-ended questions in the survey, and looking back, I wish we would have. We would have gotten a lot. It puts more work on Kristen to have to conduct these interviews.
what's an open-ended question that you'd like to maybe ask the next time?
Why they think things are getting better, or why they are optimistic about their future outlook. And look, when we break down the survey, those that are 18 to 34 are 2 to 3 times more likely to say things are going to look better for them in the future than anyone over the age of 35.
I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, so, Christian, why do you think that is?
Life hasn't had time to grind you down and spit you out.
That's a cynical answer.
Well, I do think when you're young, you're moving forward and perhaps you're getting your degree and you feel like you're moving somewhere. And so naturally you're optimistic. But I think when you're older, perhaps you've had some trip-ups. Perhaps you've not missed some payments on the house. Perhaps you've seen your pension go from $100,000 to $20,000 or whatever it is. And so you're a little more savvy, a little more jaded. So that's maybe why it is. But I thought that was fascinating, too, that young people are optimistic. So.
Let's get to some of the numbers of people's approval ratings of either elected officials or legislative bodies, because they're pretty interesting. The total approval right now of Governor Kitzhaber is at 50%, basically unchanged since September. Sue, what do you make of this number? Is this a number to be happy with if you are the governor?
When you have just slightly over a majority giving you a thumbs up, that looks pretty good. But historically, it's not great. You know, we need to see numbers in the 60-plus range to feel good about it. The same numbers are for President Obama as well. So numbers are very, very similar in this state for Obama's approval rating.
So that's the governor. For President Obama, there was a lot of movement for this. The strongly approved category increased from 21% to 29% in the last 4 months. Strongly disapprove went down from 38% to 31%. But still, even despite those changes, there's much more sort of polarized views of the president than, say, of the governor. Many more people were in the strong camp, either strongly approving or strongly disapproving of the president. What do you make of that, and why do you think he's so much more polarizing?
You know, people hold the president responsible for what's going on in the economy, and you know, we'll see that kind of polarization, and that's not surprising. When we break things down, the strong approval for Obama is actually pretty similar in terms of numbers to his strong approval. So we have, in essence, almost 30% who strongly disapprove of the president, and we have just as many strongly approve of his performance.
Now, those are the elected leaders, the individuals. Moving on to the legislature, a 44% approval rate for the legislature, for the Oregon legislature. How does that compare to numbers you often see in Oregon?
It's looking pretty good. It's looking better than I've seen in a long time. A lot of times we see numbers in the 25, 30%. So 44% doesn't look bad right now.
Especially the numbers I looked at for Congress, for U.S. Congress, and this is in national polls, in a number of national polls recently, the number is hovering around 13%. So I guess you have reasons to be happy if you're in the legislature. Kevin Matthews on our site says it feels like we're not going in the right direction, but we're not quite rushing the wrong way either. We are in the calm before the combined storms of climate change, resource exhaustion, excess bureaucracy, income polarization, etc., until they really hit hard. Christian, did you hear any of these mentioned when you were trying to get the stories behind the numbers?
I think I heard a lot of people complaining about the government and restrictions on businesses and things like that. But I think the stories of people, when they feel optimistic or pessimistic, it's very home-based, I think, when I'm talking to them at least. I know not a lot of people do say, well, I'm really worried about the climate change or something like that. Although that's in the background, they're more concerned about meeting the bills today or tomorrow, that kind of thing. So that's what I get when I talk to them. In a longer interview, you might get more. But when they're immediately like, hey, why did you say yes on this poll? It's very, what's happening today?
So. You know, Sue, Christian here is talking about the stories behind the numbers, and you said that you could go for the more open-ended questions next time, the whys. But How do you actually crunch that kind of data? What do you do with it if you have 500 responses where people, you know, have all kinds of different answers that don't fit neatly into a multiple choice, you know, grid? What do you do with it?
You have to look at a lot of data to start making sense of questions like that. And what we'll do is look at similar responses and put them into buckets. So maybe we look at, in a simple way, what are positive comments, right? Put them in a bucket together versus how many negative comments. We'll have another opportunity here in about 3 months in May to conduct another OPBD CHEM poll. So we'll make sure to ask that question.
You know, and the blog comment we just got, which he says, you know, we're not in the right direction. We're not in the wrong direction. We're in the calm before the storm of all these problems that he sees coming. Is there a choice for people? I mean, is it right direction, wrong direction, or don't know? Or is there a treading water response that's possible?
If they volunteered a response, we'll capture it, but it's not one that we offer to them. I mean, the question is posed, you know, is Oregon headed in the right direction or are things off on the wrong track? And they volunteer that they don't know or maybe give us another answer.
Christian touched on these numbers earlier, but I'd like to bring them up in terms of when you asked if people feel personally better off or worse off financially than 2 years ago, about half the people said they feel about the same financially. 35% say they're worse off. Only 16% say they're better off. But then you ask, the next question is, do you think you'll be better off than you are now 6 months from now? And there, the numbers are reversed. People, even though they just finished telling you that twice as many people are worse off now than they were the 2 years earlier, twice as many people say they think they'll be better off 6 months from now. What do you make of that optimism in the face of data saying that, you know, that more people were not better off than in the past?
If we only interviewed people over the age of 35, the numbers wouldn't look so great. But it's the 18 to 34-year-olds that are boosting these figures.
This is
They're much more
Christian's
optimism.
Folks who haven't
right.
been ground down yet.
And spat out.
Christian, what do you make of it? I mean, is it just the younger people skewing it with their you know, unbalanced optimism, or is there something sort of, I don't know, inherently American about wishing that things are going to be better and just hoping for the best?
I think there is some of that. I
ask you as a Brit who's not American.
As somebody from looking from outside, I do think there is a bit of that. There is kind of, we've had 4 years, if not more, of some real pain, financial pain, and now people are like, okay, enough already. I'm kicking into gear. I think there's a little bit of that. I also think about I going off tangent here. As you, each decade has its thing. If you look back to the 60s, it was free love, and 70s it was drugs, 80s it was Wall Street, 90s it was .com, 2000s terrorism. This is my own personal theory. And I think people are now, well, come on, let's get new. Let's do something new. And I don't want 10 years to go by where the economy does nothing that they saw in Japan and longer than that. So maybe there is that American feeling of, all right, we've been through bad times. You know, like this guy, this fabricator I spoke to in Myrtle Creek, he's making triggers for deer rifles and stocks and other things. That's an incredibly, small market, but he's going after it. And I've seen, talk to people who've done those kind of things who can make hundreds of thousands of dollars. If they do it really well and they hit the right market, there's a market for it. And I think people have been kind of in this malaise maybe for the last few years and thinking, well, if I can't get any more benefits, I'm going to try something. I've got to do something. And eventually, things begin to solidify. Now, that's not scientific. That's me just shooting from the hip as a business reporter. So,
Sue, moving on to one of the last things that you asked about in the survey is how state money, public money, is spent by the state government. One of the questions you ask is, how many cents out of every dollar do you think that the state spends do you feel is wasted? And the average amount that people came up with was 44 cents out of every dollar is wasted. But then you asked them areas that they would be happy to cut. What kinds of responses did you get?
Just like with national studies, when we ask people, what do you want to cut? The answer is nothing, right? But let's bring the deficit down. So when we pose important services like K-12 and health and human services against prisons are going to lose every time. And we see that in the numbers, where we see a larger percentage of people willing to make cuts in prisons than they do in some of these other key services like K-12 and health.
But even for prisons, 53% of respondents opposed cuts. For K through 12 education, I think it was 79%. But still, a majority opposed cuts to prisons as well, prisons and corrections more broadly. Why is this that people say money is being wasted, but they don't want money cut from various state services?
Well, let's be fair. To be fair, with some of the numbers toward government, we asked this question, and Christian and I talked about this. We ask this regularly. How many U.S. senators do we have in the state of Oregon? We don't ask them to name them. We just ask how many. 40% get it wrong. So to expect people to know the finances and the nuances of public finance for budgeting, that's a really big challenge for folks.
One of the interesting things I hear is when you ask a group of people just somewhere in a restaurant or something and say, what do your taxes go to? They often have just a blank face. They're not quite sure. That kind of link between, well, I pay for police and roads and education and military, it's just not right there. There's not a really good connection made. There's no branding. There's no kind of you think of it straight away. So it's kind of interesting.
Sue, anything you want that you know you want to add the next time you ask a big group of Oregonians these kinds of questions, a question that's strikes you now that you really want to make sure people answer the next time?
Well, let's go back to the question of why they think things are getting better for them and see if we can break that down even further.
All right. Sue Mitchell, I'm looking forward to the results next time.
Thank you.
Sue Mitchell is a managing partner at DHM Research. And Christian, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Christian Fodenwenzel. You know him. He's a reporter for OPB News. You're listening to Think Out Loud on OPB. Coming up, the effort to unionize faculty at the U of O. You're listening to Think Out Loud on OPB. I'm Dave Miller. If a group of faculty members at the University of Oregon have their way, they will soon be members of a new union. The group started collecting signatures recently. Their task now is to get a majority of eligible faculty members to sign cards seeking a union. Under Oregon law, they have 90 days to get those signatures, so the clock is ticking. If you teach at the U of O and welcome unionization or oppose it, what are your reasons? If you teach at one of the other Oregon universities that is already unionized, how does the union affect your life? Give us a call, 1-888-665-5865, or join in online at opb.org/thinkoutloud. Deborah Olson is an instructor in the College of Education at the University of Oregon and one of the organizers of the unionizing effort. She joins me now. Deborah Olson, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dave.
So why do you want to form a union?
Well, we feel that faculty need a much stronger voice in setting priorities for the academic mission of the university. And that can boil down to a couple of different, you know, major components, directing resources towards the priorities for students to have reasonably sized classes, not have to sit in the aisles, to have access to courses that they need for graduation. And currently, we feel that the instructional mission of the university is being short shrift in the priority of resources.
But how exactly do you think having a collective voice would help you as you push for these things?
Well, historically, a collective bargaining unit can negotiate working conditions, things like class sizes and access to courses, the retention and retraining of high quality instructors and researchers and innovators. So those things can be addressed in a collective bargaining agreement.
You said class size. I think it was maybe the first thing you mentioned in terms of an area you'd like to affect some collective change in. What exactly do you see in terms of class size right now, and what would you like to bring it down to?
Well, we've seen enrollment increase steadily over the last couple of years, but very little increase in faculty, which means that class sizes are getting larger and larger. And we have some very large classes being taught where students don't have desks or chairs.
So they're sitting in the aisles?
Yes.
How many classes are there where students don't even have a desk or a chair?
Well, I can't really give you that number, but I can tell you that students have a problem having even access to courses so that they can graduate on time. We have students hanging around for another term or another year even in order to have access to the courses that they need to graduate.
Now, do you think that faculty would want to be teaching more courses, or that you'd want the administration to hire more instructors?
In some cases, I mean, there's such a wide diversity in our faculty. In some cases, it could be one or the other.
But it seems like it would have to be one or the other if you, yes, unless you're going to decrease the number of students.
Right. And that, feasibly, that doesn't seem to be a direction that our state is going in, decreasing the number of students.
Why push for this now? This is not a new push, I mean, in general at the University of Oregon. That there's been talk about this and some efforts for years now. But why now?
Well, I think events of the last couple of years, and particularly in this last year, have shown that faculty feel fairly voiceless, fairly helpless in having a direct say in what goes on our campus. And the firing of our president last December was just sort of an example of that. But we've been working on this for several years, and we have seen faculty power eroding over the years.
You mentioned the firing of President LaRiviere. Does this push now that started just about 2 weeks ago have anything to do with President LaRiviere's firing?
Only in terms of consciousness raising. We've been working on this for several years.
We got a comment from M. Howell, who is a he says, I'm a full-time faculty member at PSU. Without our faculty union, the administration would laugh in our faces and perpetrate even greater frauds when explaining why our class loads are increased while our paychecks remain stagnant. The union watches out for me. The administration watches out for itself. I'm sticking with the union. Very much, I guess, an us versus them picture that M. Howell is painting here. Would a union perpetuate that kind of a relationship, are you saying you already have it anyway?
You mean a negative relationship? Like,
yeah,
that? No,
an adversarial relationship.
I don't see it necessarily as being adversarial. There are so many ways in which we can work together by joining, for example, with the University Senate to lobby Salem and to lobby Washington for additional resources. We have many things we can work together on with the administration.
We got a comment from Flash Steve against unions. He says, high school teachers are unionized. The result of collective bargaining has resulted in bigger classes and salaries remaining the same or increasing with no benefit to students. How would this be different at the college level?
Well, every union is different, and our union would be the union of the faculty of the University of Oregon, and our priorities happen to be the quality of education that students are receiving.
You've been an instructor at the University of Oregon, a professor there, non-tenure track faculty for over two decades.
Yes.
How would, and as I understand it, on a year-to-year contract there,
yes,
how would being in a union change your life personally, do you think?
Well, one thing I think I would appreciate is a multi-year contract. You know, I think after teaching here for 3 to 5 years, that perhaps a non-tenure track faculty could be offered a multi-year contract. We are very much I want to say backbone, but I don't want to insult anybody. We are very much a part of the teaching that goes on here at the university, and we are committed to high-quality teaching. But with the sort of job insecurity that some NTTF face, that's almost impossible. Some NTTF are on 3-month contracts.
That's non-tenure track faculty.
Non-tenure track faculty, and many have no health benefits at all.
Given that, do you have the same ultimate political goals as the tenure track faculty or the tenured faculty?
I think we have much more in common than we have in terms of differences. We share in common the concern about shared governance. We share in common the concern about classroom sizes and the quality of education that our students are receiving. We share in common the access to resources for high-quality research. So I think those things make us much stronger than the differences.
Deborah Olson, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us.
Thank you so much.
Deborah Olson is an instructor in the College of Education at the University of Oregon. Thanks so much to everybody on the show today. Tune in tonight at 9 p.m. for live coverage of the results of the special election in the 1st District. We're going to have reporters with the Bonamici and Cornelis campaigns And OPB's political analyst Bill Lunch will join us. That's tonight at 9 o'clock. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to air an interview with Governor Kitzhaber. We're actually going to be recording that interview in just a few hours. So if you have questions for the governor, you can leave them on our website right now or send them to us on Twitter or Facebook. We are Think Out Loud OPB. For the radio show that listens, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dave Miller. Have a great day.